Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 6th of December. This hour of the program, we are delighted to have in our studios here in Milwaukee the president of the Southern Poverty Law Center. We've talked with people from that center for a number of years now, and we're going to be talking about all that they're doing, and it's difficult work and very important work, raising awareness of hate crimes, including the Sikh temple shooting in Oak Creek in Wisconsin. They were tracking, actually, Wade Michael Page for a number of years before he opened fire at that Oak Creek Sikh temple. Richard Cohen will be speaking today at a special awards ceremony that they're having at the Italian Community Center, the Interfaith Conference of Greater Milwaukee. For those of you not familiar with the Southern Poverty Law Center, they're dedicated to fighting hate and bigotry and to seeking justice for the most vulnerable members of our society. They use litigation, education, and employ. We'll ask Richard to tell us more about this, a three-pronged strategy to battle racial and social injustice. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Richard during the course of this hour. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Hello, Richard. Thanks so much for being with us.
Great to be here, Kathleen.
Let's start with that Sikh temple shooting, which really rattled us in southeastern Wisconsin and actually the nation. You had been tracking this shooter for a number of years.
Since the year 2000. He was a well-known figure on the hate rock scene. Played in a number of bands. One of the bands he started was called End Apathy. And the idea was the white supremacist movement's just a bunch of talk. We need to take action. And although he hadn't engaged in any violence, you know, that kind of firmament from which he came, it was predictable that something bad would happen, I think.
And there is some kind of movement, tell me about this, to recruit members of the military because they know how to use weapons?
You know, it's been a long-standing problem. Back in 1986, a long time ago, we realized or we detected or uncovered the fact that people in the military in North Carolina, Camp Lejeune, were training members of a Klan group in the use of weapons. We wrote a letter to Caspar Weinberger, who was then the Secretary of Defense, saying, this has got to stop. Weinberger issued regulations, but unfortunately those regulations didn't go far enough, and military people still were cavorting with white supremacists. Then in 1995, 96, there was a terrible racial hate crime out of Fort Bragg in Fayetteville, North Carolina. There was a cadre of Nazis in the military, and they ritualistically killed and slain a black couple. Wade Michael Page was at Fort Bragg at the time, and it was really the experience in the military that radicalized him. And, you know, this to go back to the military point, it's been a long-standing problem. And recently we finally convinced the Pentagon to basically adopt a zero-tolerance policy when it came to, you know, members of hate groups in the military. At first, it's debilitating to the force. And secondly, you don't want the government to be training people in munitions who may then turn around and use it on civilians in this country. I mean, it's really quite a dangerous thing. So we've been fighting that battle for a long time.
And what does zero tolerance mean?
Well, any kind of activity, distributing hate literature, membership in any hate groups is grounds for discipline now in the military. You know, until a couple of years ago, we were sending the Pentagon basically, you know, reams of paper that reflected that there were active duty military soldiers on white supremacists' social networks posing with Mein Kampf, talking about going, you know, to kill sand people in Iraq. It was quite outrageous.
By zero tolerance, should it not be you shouldn't be in the military?
Well, that's the idea, right? You know, just let's screen people. You know, with fighting two wars, there was this sense, I think, that the military had maybe relaxed some of its requirements. and in order to meet the manpower needs. And I think the military has now taken care of that.
Mm-hmm. So when you were tracking Wade Michael Page for all of those years, what did you discover about him and what did you want done? And were you shocked by his action from your analysis of him?
Well, you know, we gather material about the white supremacist movement from all over the country. Right now, we're tracking approximately 1,000 hate groups.
1,000 hate groups?
1,000 hate groups completely across the country. And, you know, someone like Wade Michael Page is typical. You know, he's come in through the hate rock scene. He's, you know, he doesn't have a lot of human capital, I'm afraid. And so he clings to this idea that he's the master race. I mean, he has a choice. He can be the down and out guy without a future, or he can be, you know, part of the master race whose birthright has been stolen by the nefarious Jew and the country is being given to people of color. That's kind of the mindset. And so he gets involved in this hate rock movement and, you know, sings about this kind of stuff. And were we surprised that violence occurred? Absolutely not. Could we have predicted that it would be Wade Michael Page? No, we could never say that. 3 months before the Sikh shooting, we put out a training video for law enforcement. It was skinheads understanding the threat. And what we're trying to do is help law enforcement understand the skinhead culture. What were the signs of racist skinheads? Not everyone with a shaved head is a dangerous person. There are anti-racist skinheads in this country. But many skinhead groups, the Confederate hammer skins, things like that, are extraordinarily dangerous. So we put out a video to try to help law enforcement understand the threat that skinheads pose to themselves and to others. We had pictures of Page in that video. We distributed 50,000 copies to law enforcement agencies throughout the country, including law enforcement agencies in Wisconsin. That's not to say that they should have known that Wade Michael Page was going to go on a rampage in Oak Creek, but it is to say that skinheads are a dangerous group.
And law enforcement agencies would have used this video to just be on the lookout?
Well, what they would do is they maybe would have a morning meeting where they have their roll call. They might show a training since movement. This is a movement of people who believe that the government has no authority to them. And in 2010, a terrible tragedy occurred in West Memphis, Arkansas, where sovereign citizens killed two police officers. Two extraordinary things about the event. First, the killing was captured on the dash cam video of the officer's car. And secondly, one of the officers was the son of the chief of police who happened to come upon the scene to see his son slain. That officer, that chief of police, agreed, because he thought it was so important, to narrate the video for us. And now he's traveling around the country training law enforcement officers to be aware of the signs of sovereign citizens so what happened to his son doesn't happen to any other police officer. Mm.
There was a meeting, I'm sure you're probably aware of it, and maybe these people will be at the luncheon today, of son of one of the priests who was killed at the Sikh temple and also a former member of one of these groups.
I've heard
of that, yes. And I guess they met for 4 hours, and it's just extraordinary to me that this kind of meeting could take place.
Yes.
Would you do, and do you do videos of that kind of complete change of heart? Are there possibilities for that change of heart? How is it important for us to put together opportunities for that kind of change of heart?
I think that's a great question, Kathleen, and I think there are opportunities like that. last year, we sponsored a film that was shown on MSNBC. It was called Erasing Hate, and it was a story about a skinhead, Brian Widener, who was a badass, and that's the only way one can put it. He cut people. He hurt people. It was horrible. And then he had a change of heart. He got older, he got married, and he saw, you know, the error of his ways. The problem was his face was covered with these horrible, horrible racist tattoos. And so we agreed to help Brian. We paid for the tattoo removal. And the agreement was that we were going to film it and tell his story. And so it was the physical erasing hate from his face, and it was the metaphorical erasing hate from his soul. And so that was the story, and MSNBC broadcast it last year. Lawrence Downs was the introduced the film.
And is it important? It's hard when you tell me these stories. It just makes you cringe. It makes you sick to your stomach. Is there a way for us to understand and to prevent people from even being attracted by this kind of horrible hate? I mean, is it simple to say we need to do something in schools? We need to be careful of drug abuse? What in the world can we do?
I think there are a lot. First, I don't think there's any simple answer to a question like this. The reason people join hate groups are maybe similar to the reasons that people join gangs, a sense of belonging, a sense of alienation from mainstream society institutions. There are a lot of factors at play. Schools have a part to play in counteracting it. Our churches have a part to play in counteracting it. Community groups in general have a part to play. There are no easy answers in that regard.
We now have an African-American president.
Yes.
People of color were incredibly important in the last election in reelecting our first African-American president. I guess it would stand to reason that you might be seeing more hate groups now. Am I right?
Yes, you are. You know, hate groups have grown by about 70% since the year 2000. And, you know, there are a lot of factors at play, but the primary factor driving it is the changing demographics of our country.
Mm-hmm.
In 1970, when the Interfaith Coalition of Greater Milwaukee was founded, less than one in five persons in our country was non-white. Today, that figure's doubled, and the country's having growing pains. Obama represents that change in many people's minds. Some see him as, you know, the secret Kenyan-born Muslim. Do you know? That's this image of him. And so most of the growth in hate groups actually occurred before Obama became the president. It's continued since then. But the other thing we've seen has been this tremendous explosion of these radical anti-government groups, militia groups, things like that, sovereign citizens groups that have exploded since Obama became the president. The last time we saw anything like this was in the mid-90s when Clinton was president. And what happened at that time was, of course, the Oklahoma City bombing, you know, kind of done by someone who hated the government and was a committed racist. And we're seeing signs of things like that now. People flying planes into government buildings, militia groups plotting to, you know, spread ricin in cities, attack government buildings. And so we're seeing, and of course there's been, after Obama was elected, a real explosion of racial hate crimes, as well as a uptick in, you know, threats against the president himself.
How do you use the courts to deal with all of this? What kind of litigation are you involved in, Richard?
A wide variety. You know, we have a motto at the Southern Poverty Law Center: you have a right to hate, but you don't have a right to hurt. And when people cross that line, we try to hold them accountable. The key thing that we do is not simply sue the people who have committed the hate crime, because often those are people who have no money and, you know, the criminal justice system can take care of them. What we try to do is go after the organizations themselves and their leaders who encourage, inspire, and foment this kind of violence. Our signature case, our case in some sense that symbolizes this best, was a case that we had in Alabama against the country's most notorious Klan group. It was the same Klan group that had blown up the 16th Street Baptist Church, killing those four little girls, the same Klan group that had beat the Freedom Riders when they were through the South. And this Klan group in the mid-80s lynched a black student named Michael Donald in order basically to show Klan strength in South Alabama. We sued not just the people who carried out the ritualistic slaying, but the group itself, and got from an all-white jury in Mobile, Alabama, a $7 million verdict that bankrupted the Klan. And we seized their headquarters, and with the money, Miss Donald, the mother, bought the first house she had ever owned. So it was really quite sweet justice for us. So, you know, and we have done a number of those kinds of cases throughout the country, really from, you know, coast to coast.
So how do we peacefully live into this change that's taking place, which is significant, mm-hmm, in this country?
There was a study done recently, a few years ago, by Robert Putnam. He is a sociologist best known for his book, Bowling Alone. Mm-hmm. And what he did was gather evidence or gather data from communities throughout the country about levels of trust in the community. And, you know, do you trust your neighbor? Not just your neighbor who's different from you, but your neighbor who looks similar to you. Do you trust them? And then he plotted the levels of trust against the diversity of the community, held, you know, a variety of factors constant as they do in these multivariate regressions. And what he found was that as diversity increased, trust went down. Levels of civic participation went down. People retreated into themselves. In Putnam's words, diversity brought out the turtle in all of us. We retreated to ourselves. So the answer in the most general sense to your question is that we have to come out of our shells. We have to reach across the aisle. We have to form bonds in our communities and our churches and our civic organizations that unite people towards a common purpose. That's not just we should sit around and sing kumbaya, because frankly, things like that don't work. But we need to unite in common projects that have, you know, a superordinate goal, you know, whether it's cleaning up our cities, whether it's, you know, fixing our schools, whether it's building public parks, places where people can come together for a common purpose and work across their differences. Those are the ultimate answers. We train people to do those things in schools, and we train people to do those things in our churches, but it's the things across the community that maybe are the hardest, because we don't have structures really in place to do those things. Schools and churches, they're highly structured. It's the things across the community that are harder.
Mm-hmm. I'm thinking in... You know about this community well, but many of us in this area learned a great deal about the Sikh community after that horrendous massacre.
Yes.
And their response to it. And I think that they were instrumental in opening people's eyes to a whole different world and to forgiveness in a very profound way.
It's unbelievable. Yes. You know, the strength of that community. At the time of the massacre, we actually had a law student who was a Sikh. From the University of Washington. He was working for us at the time. And at the very moment of the killings, he was in Georgia doing outreach to the Sikh community there, Sikh students who were being, you know, terribly bullied in their schools. This is a problem across the country. People, you know, they see Sikhs, they're different. They look different. They're turbans. They're darker skinned typically. And so they're the other. And, you know, it's a tremendous problem. I think Sikhs would be victimized regardless of whether people confuse them with Muslims. But I think the problem for the Sikh community is, of course, exacerbated by people's assumption that they are Muslims. 4 days after 9/11, a Sikh gentleman was killed in Arizona, Balbir Singh Sodhi, by someone who thought, you know, he was, you know, was a Muslim. And that doesn't mean that the Sikh community should put up big signs on their churches.
Say, we're not Muslim.
We're not
right.
Muslims. That's not the answer. The answer is, you know, kind of dealing with the underlying problem. So the Sikh community has been incredibly heroic. And, you know, you couldn't have kind of a more peaceful community. It's really quite incredible.
Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering, before we go to phone calls, how you as a human being who deals with this every day, knowing what's out there, what your thoughts are about human beings. Do you worry about threats every night before you go to sleep and you can't sleep because of all of this? Or,
you know, we've had a fair number of threats directed at us. About 30 people have gone to jail in connection with various plots to blow up our building, shoot kind of our founder, those kinds of things. But the truth of the matter is, in day-to-day sense, you don't think a whole lot about it. We have some security. You think about it sometimes, but not a lot. Also, you know, I do believe that people can be redeemed. I don't think there's anyone who's kind of beyond hope. And I think it's also important to recognize that we're talking about people like Wade Michael Page, the person with the swastika. But the real problem, you know, most hate crimes are committed by persons who are unaffiliated with hate groups. And, you know, they're the kids down the street. And so the problem, I think it's easy to say to ourselves, oh, gosh, it's isolated to this, the people with the swastikas emblazoned on their head. The unfortunate truth is that that's not the case. And so I worry about the people who look like me, and I believe that the person with the swastika can be redeemed. You have to have some hope to do this kind of work.
I would imagine. We welcome phone calls for Richard, and we'll take them momentarily. Richard Cohen is our guest. He is president of the Southern Poverty Law Center. He's in Milwaukee to be the keynote speaker at the Interfaith Conference of Greater Milwaukee's Lunch Awards Luncheon, which is taking place today. And here, we have a lot of phone calls. Well, I'll give you the number. You can't get through right now, but you will be able to do so eventually. The number is 800-488-6655. The email is talk@wpr.org. And the Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. So let's start our phone calls with Victor in Milwaukee. Hello, Victor.
Good morning, Kathleen. Good morning, Richard.
Hi, Victor.
Let me start off by saying, it goes back to what Martin Luther King says, this prejudice and these attitudes start right at the dinner table. It starts at home. That's where a child's development years happen, and they come up with these ideas of whether they want to accept another race or not. Does your organization monitor these radio programs, particularly like Rush Limbaugh, who made a statement that went viral, saying that white America is dead? This is right after President Obama was reelected. And I'm not so much onto the talk show hosts themselves. They're the lightning rod. But listen to the people who call into these radio stations. And though they're voicing their comments and everything, that's America right there, not the talk show hosts. Do you often wonder, where do they get these attitudes from, and why do they just focus in on Rush Limbaugh and radio talk show hosts like that? It's like a magnet.
I think you're absolutely right, Victor. This does start at the dinner table. And I think the danger of some of the talk shows is that they cater to the worst elements of society. You know, they try to polarize the nation in order to build up their own audience. They try to say incendiary things so people will, you know, tune into them and hear what's next. Also, you know, those shows tend to be a bit of an echo chamber. The people who listen in are the people who kind of agree. I'll read articles in the newspaper sometimes about our work or about the work of other social justice organizations, and then I'll look at the comments. And sometimes they're really quite depressing.
Yes, they are.
But on the other hand, I think it's usually the people who are on maybe the opposite side of us who are making the comments and who are calling in. So I think the country's better off than one might think from looking at the comments in the newspaper, from looking at kind of some of the ugliness in the call-in shows. So I think you're right, but I don't think it's perhaps as bad as we might assume.
Except it's not very balanced, is it? When you – even those who are – we've got the liberals, we've got conservatives, and we've got – it's really opinionated, not very substantiated in fact or in compassion, actually, conversation going on across the radio dial, which I think is awful. I just think that it's vindictive. It's the power is in the hands of one person, and you're right that everybody is looking for sort of an agenda. And you hear the same rhetoric, even from people who will call into this show on public radio, that they've heard on another radio show with the same language, and you hear it in the comment section. It's all the same language. Everybody's saying the same thing because somebody is thinking for them.
Yeah, I think that that's right. I watch more television than I listen to the radio. And, you know, I'm dismayed by what I hear on Fox. On the other hand, sometimes I feel like MSNBC is going too far.
Right.
And so, I mean, I think it's a problem. It's a problem on both ends of the spectrum, I think.
Yeah. Victor, thank you very much for the call. We go to Sarah in Zion, Illinois. Hi, Sarah.
Good morning. I'm very excited to talk to you, sir, because you're just the person for what I've been thinking about, because this week I've just been rereading the book Beloved by Toni Morrison, and also, well, there's a passage in the book where one of the main characters is looking back on what he experienced as a slave and then thinking about all the violence that was directed toward the black black people since the end of slavery, and he's just overwhelmed, and he says, what are these people? What, you know, white people, what are these people? How can they do these things? And so when I'm listening to the program today, I'm, you know, you're talking about social and political circumstances going on right now, but, and that's true, I'm sure, but, you know, the history of racism and violence in this, towards blacks in this country goes back to, you know, of course, its very beginning, and that question that this character is asking, you know, I've been thinking about it, and I'm, Kathleen, you had that show about Thomas Jefferson the other day, and the guest was talking about how people in the South were terrified that the blacks would rise up and kill them all.
Right.
So I'm thinking about that, and also I wonder if there's, I have this theory that deep down inside, people in the South knew that what they were doing was wrong, and the only way they could justify it was to demonize black people, and if they killed them all, then they wouldn't have to, you know, then they were right to hate them. So I don't know, I just wonder what your thoughts are about that.
You know, it's hard to believe, I think, that it's when you look back on it, kind of the level of cruelty, the level of inhumanity, it's, you know, it's kind of very, very difficult to fathom, I think. But, of course, it raises the question of, you know, what are we blind to in our time? If people were blind to the injustice, you know, 50 years ago, 100 years ago to what they were doing, what are we blind to in our time? And I think those are important factors to think about. You know, do large segments of our communities think about maybe kind of the recent immigrants as the other? Do they vilify them? Do they talk about them being diseased in the way that people talked about Eastern European immigrants at the turn of the last century? Or, you know, kind of do they talk about them being drunks and imbeciles in the way that people talked about the Irish in the 19th century? So I think what you're saying is absolutely accurate, but it raises the question, I think, of what are we blind to in our time?
Mm-hmm. It's a question we need to ask.
Always, always.
Yeah. You think in some ways we should be over all of this, and yet I know that in schools there are still racial epithets being thrown by people from different basketball teams or football teams to white, more suburban schools from city schools, that all of that is still going on in this community now. In some ways you just shake your head and you say, wait a second, haven't we been through all of this before? But you're right, it's still going on now and it needs to be addressed.
Yeah, I agree completely. Kids in school, young people are often trying to forge an identity. And they're trying on different identities, and they often define themselves as not like someone else. And, you know, that can take a real ugly turn, I'm afraid.
Mm-hmm. I know the Interfaith Conference, and you're aware of this, is doing a mix it up this year across the state. Would it be that all schools would be very integrated and people from a very young age would be exposed to the richness of all of these different cultures?
Yeah.
And what makes life interesting in many ways? But this is a deliberate attempt to make sure that that happens, and it's being embraced by 52 schools from around the state, which
is good. That's actually a program that we run.
Oh, it is?
Yeah.
Great.
And it's run through our Teaching Tolerance program. And, you know, once a year we ask people to sit at a cafeteria with someone new, someone who they don't know, whatever the dividing lines might be in their school. Maybe it's between the geeks and the jocks. Maybe it's race. Maybe it's religion. Just sit with someone kind of new. This past year we had about 5,000 schools that participated, including, you know, over 50 in Wisconsin, including a number in Milwaukee itself, Bayview High, for example. An interesting thing, a group called the American Family Association, a very anti-gay group, a group that has, you know, talked about gay people being responsible for the Holocaust, crazy stuff like this, sent out 2 million emails to their followers trying to get them to shut down Mix It Up at Lunch Day, because they said that it promoted the, you know, homosexual agenda. And, you know, luckily most schools resisted that. I think, you know, there were a lot of newspaper and television coverage of it. I think they ended up looking like fools. But the idea that they have a mailing list or an email list of 2 million, and some schools got more than 1,000 phone calls saying, what are you teaching my children? And so there's still, you know, kind of a lot of ugliness out there.
And what about, because we're seeing fairly rapid, it's not all that rapid, but fairly rapid change in same-sex marriage, yes, and embracing, particularly among the young people, of homosexuality, that they don't even think twice about it.
Yes.
If you have that kind of happen in society, is the backlash to that community pretty significant, Richard?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think the change is, you know, in terms of social change, it's really quite quick. And as more and more people come out, more and more people, in some sense, are potential targets. And so at the same time that we see, you know, kind of this progress, we see kind of the backlash. It might be interesting to some of your listeners. We put out a film a couple years ago about a very famous case that occurred in Wisconsin, occurred in Ashland. It was a case of horrible anti-gay bullying. The victim was this kid named Jamie Nabosny. And it was the first case that held that public school officials had a constitutional obligation to protect children from anti-gay bullying. It's a decision of the Seventh Circuit. And we made a film, a documentary film about the case, and have distributed 90,000 copies to schools around the country free of charge to about 4,000 schools in Wisconsin. And it, you know, the film really caught fire because it came out at literally at the same time that Tyler Clemente was jumping off that bridge, the GW bridge, after being bullied at Rutgers. So, you know, it's a tremendous problem, but I think that we're making progress as well.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Sarah, very much.
Thank
for
you,
the
Sarah.
Let's go to Karen in Rolling Stone, Minnesota. Hi, Karen.
Oh, perfect segue, Kathleen, and wonderful program. I had called a little bit earlier to talk about Teaching Tolerance magazine and all the incredible work the Southern Poverty Law Center does to help children become tolerant and grow up to be tolerant adults. I was teaching at Stout in the late 1980s and early 1990s, and one day in a restroom downstairs in the basement of one of the classroom buildings where I had an office, I found a stack probably about 8 inches tall of pamphlets that were the most hateful rubbish that I had ever seen, very racially hateful. And I took them and tossed most of them. I kept a couple. And when I went in 1992 to teach at the high school, I brought some with me, and we used those for analyzing the kind of writing that this was and what assumptions could we probably make that were about the person that may have written that. At any rate, at that time, I became very aware of all the kinds of prejudice and nastiness that can go on that are aimed towards young people. And I discovered the Southern Poverty Law Center and have been a supporter for all these years. I want to say that the materials that they give, as your guest just said, for free to teachers and schools, are incredibly fine. I was the student council advisor for 11 years, and I brought some of those to our student council. We did mix it up at lunch day regularly. In fact, the first time we did it, the kids all said, if we just leave the tables arranged the way they are in the cafeteria, it will never work. People will just go to their same spot. We have to move all the tables around and make it look really different. So they did. and it was a huge success.
Karen, thank you so much for your call. It's good to know that you're making contact.
Well, you know, I appreciate, Karen, your calling in. I really do appreciate that endorsement. And I've never talked with someone who lives in a place called Rolling Stone. That's really cool.
I've never told her that, but I know that. Yeah, Rolling Stone, Minnesota. Now, those kinds of materials are available, Richard, to schools?
They're available free of charge to schools. We send out Teaching Tolerance magazine twice a year to almost 500,000 educators throughout the country. About 12,000 subscribers are in Wisconsin. And any teacher in America can sign up and get a copy of the magazine regularly. Also, through the magazine, we promote and market the films that we make. The films that we make are, you know, accompanied by teacher's guides, and they, too, are available free of charge to any school. We usually limit that to one or two per school, any school that asks for it. We've put out, you know, a number of films. Four have been nominated for Academy Awards.
Really?
Two have won Oscars. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's great to hold the statue, right? That's really neat. But the letters that we get back from teachers talking about the difference that the films have made in their schools, they're more important to us than the awards.
So you're on the internet. I'm sure you go to Southern Poverty Law Center.
We're not hard to find.
I'm sure. Thank you, Karen, very much for your call.
Thank you, Karen.
Eric in Sun Prairie. Hi.
Hello, ma'am. I'm just calling. I have a few quick questions. I want to make sure that I don't come off as in any way racist. I'm just thinking, do we really need hate crime legislation? I mean, if somebody goes into a shopping mall and shoots a bunch of random people, is that not just as bad as going into the Sikh temple?
That's a good question, and that's a good question. You know, I would say there is a need for hate crime legislation, even if people are going to be punished for what they do otherwise. And it's at a number of different levels. Hate crimes tend to victimize kind of not just the people who are the immediate victims of the crime, but they tend to send shock waves through an entire community. When someone is killed at the Sikh temple because of his or her religion, it's a threat to every member of the Sikh community. And so it's because of that larger threat that we tend to have a higher level of punishment for hate crimes. Also, hate crime legislation tends to drive police training. When a particular group is designated in a hate crime law, police training typically follows, and police become more sensitive to that community. So the point that you're making, Eric, is a good one, but I think there's a strong argument that can be made in favor of hate crimes nevertheless.
Thank you, Karen. Kathleen in Milwaukee. Hi.
Good morning. Thank you so much for covering this issue. Let me just – I'm from a very small town up north, which I will not name. But in 1971, my younger sister – through a housewarming party because my parents had just built a new house. And I was a college student at Marquette. And 13 of my friends and I went and returned home to this small town. And we went to the local bowling alley, which was a hangout. And several of the women who went with me happened to be gay. And one of the guys was the first African-American to ever really step foot in this town. And they actually had a vigilante party in this small town. And the Leon Claxton is his name, wonderful man from Florida, whose father was a very famous black music promoter in Florida. And my girlfriends and I from that small town, a bunch of us, you know, how we clumped together, went to the restroom. And I came out, and the vigilante had surrounded Leon. And I am a diminutive person of similar stature as Kathleen, and kind of went up to the guys and said, "Hi, is there a problem here?" And they're like, "Oh, Kathleen, we didn't know he was with you."
Oh.
And they backed off because, not because I was any physical threat to them, but because they knew my family, and I have a huge family, and they still wouldn't have been a threat because we believe in peace and justice. Fast forward about 15 years, I became a Peace Corps volunteer in Africa for 2.5 years, come home, and immediately become a foster parent to an African-American child. And I was advised to not to bring him back to this small town because people would think that I had become pregnant in Africa and that he would not be welcome. And that people were not even told that I had... and it was supposed to be foster care to adoption because of that. And fast forward again to 5 years ago when my cousin openly adopts, he and his wife openly adopt a black child 3 days after Christmas. And this year we elected Tammy Baldwin to our state senate. And her homosexuality was not even a part of the discussion. And if you look at things like in 1948 or so, whenever it was, South Pacific came out, the fact that Joe and the Polynesian girl were having a relationship was very scandalous. South Pacific, written by, Showboat, written by Edna Ferber from Appleton in the mid-1920s, terribly scandalous about a black woman passing as a white woman on the Showboat. And here in Milwaukee, this, just recently, they did Miss Saigon at Pius XI, the Catholic school, the same time that DSHA, Divine Savior Holy Angels, another Catholic school, did Legally Blonde.
Thank you, Kathleen, very much for your call. Well, you want to talk about the arc of her life. Have things changed?
Well, it's right remarkable that she mentioned South Pacific because, of course, I remember the song that had the refrain,
"You've got to be carefully taught.
Mm-hmm. And we had a case a couple years ago in Kentucky where this horrible Klan group had beaten this kid who they assumed was Latino. He identified as a Kuna Indian. His father, I say he's a lot like Obama. His father was from Panama. His mother was a white woman from Kentucky. And our client, Jordan Groover, he had the birth certificate from Bismarck, North Dakota to prove that he was one of us. Any event, you know, he was beaten savagely by this Klan group. We sued the group and its leaders. And our co-counsel during the case at the closing argument basically sang the words of South Pacific about how you must be carefully taught. And the whole idea behind it was to have the jury send a message, a moral lesson to the community, to speak for the community and say, this is not the community that we want to have. And back to Kathleen's point, you know, when you think about, you know, kind of the jury verdicts that have resounded, you know, kind of across the country that we've been involved in, in the 50s, there was jury nullification where, you know, maybe the facts were clear, but all white juries would not convict white people of killing black people in the Deep South. You know, I don't want to say racial prejudice is gone because there's nothing could be further from the truth. But, you know, it is quite different today than it was 50 years ago or 40 years ago and 30 years ago. Sometimes when you're young, I'm no longer young, but when you're young and your horizon of time is 10 years, 5 years short, it's hard to appreciate any change. But I think with people who take a longer span, people like Kathleen, who can look back to 1971 and then fast forward to today, I think that the arc of her life reflects the changes that we've had in our country.
Thanks, Kathleen, for the call. Richard Cohen is our guest this hour. He is president of the Southern Poverty Law Center. They've been doing work for a number of years, combating prejudice, raising awareness of hate crimes, teaching, doing wonderful education work all over the country, putting together films addressing the issues of tolerance. And he's speaking today. He's the keynote speaker at the Interfaith Conference of Greater Milwaukee Awards Luncheon in Milwaukee today. More phone calls momentarily. Thanks, Kathleen, for yours. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our line's been busy. There is an opening right now. Our email, if you'd like to use that, you could, is talk@WPR.org, and we'll leave information about the Southern Poverty Law Center on our Facebook page as well, which is the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program, we were saddened to learn that Dave Brubeck died yesterday. Today would have been his 92nd birthday. He gave us so much music. You know, if he had only given us Take Five, that would have been enough in my book to make him an important contribution to music in the world. I remember hearing him in, it must have been Soldier's Field in Chicago or maybe Grant Park years and years ago. Take Five, he played it, and I was captivated. Mark Davis will be joining us. He is chair of the Jazz Studies Department at the Wisconsin Conservatory of Music. He's also a jazz pianist, and will be playing some of Dave Brubeck's wonderful compositions and his cover of other wonderful compositions. And I was talking to Richard about this. He had an integrated band in the 1950s. You know, talk about not that long ago. Deans of colleges were saying, "I'm sorry, we don't want you to play because you have a bass player who's black."
It's amazing, you know? Isn't it?
It is amazing. It is amazing. All right, let's go to John in Stoughton. Hi, John.
Hi. A couple of things that have really sparked some interest in mine. One, the notion of you have to dehumanize somebody to really hate them, and that you have to be taught to hate. And then you parallel that to what we just experienced in our election cycle here, where the behaviors that we tolerated all of our out of our politicians, if that was a third grade class, those kids would be kept in from recess and taught to talk to each other in more polite and humane ways. And isn't that kind of feeding the same kind of energy that, that in some people creates the level of hate and violence that we started this conversation with?
Those are great points, John. You know, some of the rhetoric during the election season was quite dismaying. And I'm not just talking about the rhetoric from the kind of right-wing kooks. You know, you have someone like John Sununu, you know, the former governor of New Hampshire, saying things like, Obama needs to learn how to be an American. And what is that? What is that about? Or, of course, the ever-present Newt Gingrich, who, you know, says, you know, Obama has an anti-colonial Kenyan worldview, and Obama being an imposter, an authentically dishonest is what he called him. And, you know, when you hear these kinds of things in the mainstream, you know, that's it's a warning, because what's beneath that, you know, in other spheres is, you know, even uglier. Another mainstream phenomenon I think it's worth commenting on are the Tea Parties. Well, don't get me wrong. I would never say everyone who identifies with the Tea Parties are a racist or extremist. I never say that. There are lots of reasons to be angry at our government, both for the way it's handled domestic policy and foreign affairs. But I think we would be blind to the fact, blind if we didn't recognize that there were deeply racist elements in the Tea Party and deeply conspiratorial ones. You know, these ugly signs of held at Tea Party rallies of Obama, you know, with a bone through his nose, and, you know, Obamacare, and this kind of this African thing, and Obama's, you know, kind of this Muslim conspiracy and whatnot. It's, you know, kind of very, very ugly. Then you have like a fool like Donald Trump, who gets all of this airtime on Fox News.
Talking, he gets it everywhere.
It's absurd. And I mean, he's a joke, and I don't say that simply because he has bad hair. You know, he's an ugly, ugly, you know, person who says things to, I guess, promote his brand. And but people hear that, and they take it one step further. And it's kind of a downward spiral.
Yeah. Thanks, John, for the call. Tony in Athens, hi.
Hi, thank you very much. I love the Southern Poverty Law Center's work. I used to be a teacher and would use teaching tolerance in the films in my classroom. And thank you for the commentary on the tacit racism or the subtle racism, yet de facto racism that was so present on the right, especially in the last election cycle and continues to be. My comment, though, is on the title of the magazine, Teaching Tolerance. I think at the very least it's kind of a low bar for a title. It almost has like a perverse effect, like we just want people to tolerate. There still can be this racism. I think we should uproot racism. How about teaching dignity or teaching decency or teaching equality? I think that I think we're kind of starting from a weird spot with the title of tolerance. Like, we don't like that they're supposed that they're this way. Essentially, they're black or they're Latino, or, you know. But we have to tolerate them. I think, you know, we should have teaching egalitarianism or something like that.
Richard,
great point, Tony. we get a lot of comments about teaching tolerance, and I think, you know, it does. I think there is a sense of the word in everyday you know language that is kind of begrudging acceptance, and I think that's a bad thing. There are other uses of tolerance that I think are broader. The best thing I can say for it, or thing that I would say for it, is that teaching tolerance has a lot of alliteration, and so it's tended to be a good title. But your point is well taken. I understand it. We hear it often.
Yeah, I'd have to change all those presses.
Yeah, it'd be tough.
Yeah. We have about a minute left. I'm wondering if you have recommendations or what you do in your personal life to counter what you hear rhetorically from people who ought to know better on the radio or in Congress, or if you encounter some act of hatred in your personal life, what you do with that? Do we all need to learn how to speak up?
I think it's very important not to let hate pass without you know, putting your foot down and saying something. That doesn't mean you have to be ugly to people who say, you know, things that are unthinking. But it does mean that one should say, hey, Kathleen, why do you say that? What did you mean by that? And get people to stop and think. The other thing I think is important is to listen to a diversity of opinions. It would be great if, you know, all the Fox listeners for a day would listen to MSNBC. And it would also be great for all the MSNBC listeners to listen to Fox for a day. And, you know, just kind of draw upon, you know, kind of a diverse range of opinion. The last thing I would say is it's awfully important to get a diverse group of friends, because we often reflect the attitudes of those people who are around us. And if we simply hang out with people who are just like us, we won't grow. And so I think it's really important to reach across the aisle and, you know, make friends with someone new.
Thank you, Richard. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Have a good lunch.
Thank
Richard
you.
Cohen, president of the Southern Poverty Law Center. He'll be the keynote speaker at the Interfaith Conference of Greater Milwaukee Awards Luncheon taking place today at the Italian Community Center. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and Brett Jaspers for producing this program. Thanks for all of your calls, everybody. I'm sorry we couldn't get to more of you, but there's more time. And talk about Dave Brubeck coming up.